This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Odalisque, written by Neal Stephenson and narrated by Simon Preble, Kevin Pariseau, and Catherine Kellgren.
Hi, I'm Neal Stephenson. Newton and Leibniz were the two greatest minds in the era of the Baroque cycle. And in his life, I don't think Newton had ever encountered anyone who could rival his brilliance. And when he did encounter people whom he perceived as potential rivals, he reacted rather poorly to them. He was not a man of great social skills. And as his career was on the rise, the people in the scientific community started to become aware of a young German man about the same age as Newton, whom they sometimes referred to as Il Monstro, the monster, meaning not a Frankenstein monster kind of person, but someone who was monstrously talented. And that person, of course, was Leibniz. And he showed up in London and made quite an impression on the fellows of the Royal Society with his idea for a calculating machine and for some of his mathematical achievements. And at that point, a rivalry came into existence between those two men that continued until Leibniz died. So in writing stories, rivalries and tensions between different people who want different things tend to make for a good story. And so I very early decided that the rivalry between these two great minds, both of whom had extensive connections in the power structures of their societies, would serve as the backbone of the Baroque cycle. And it's in this volume, Odalisque, that we begin to see that rivalry come into flower, and we start to see how it's going to shape the lives of both of these men for the next several decades. Now, I hope you enjoy Odalisque.
Whitehall Palace, February 1685. Like a horseman who reins in a wild stallion that has borne him willy-nilly across several counties, or a ship's captain who, after scudding before a gale through a bad night, hoists sail and gets underway once more, navigating through unfamiliar seas, thus Dr. Daniel Waterhouse, Anno Domini 1685, watching King Charles II die at Whitehall Palace. Much had happened in the previous 12 years, but nothing was really different. Daniel's world had been like a piece of caoutchouc that stretched but did not rupture and never changed its true shape. After he'd gotten his doctorate, there had been nothing for him at Cambridge save lecturing to empty rooms, tutoring dull courtiers' sons, and watching Isaac recede further into the murk, pursuing his quest for the philosophic Mercury and his occult studies of the Book of Revelation and the Temple of Solomon. So Daniel had moved to London, where events went by him like musket balls. John Comstock's ruin, his moving out of his house, and his withdrawal from the presidency of the Royal Society had seemed epochal at the time. Yet within weeks, Thomas More Anglesey had not only been elected president of the Royal Society, but also bought and moved into Comstock's house, the finest in London, royal palaces included. The upright, conservative arch-Anglican had been replaced with a florid papist, but nothing was really different, which taught Daniel that the world was full of powerful men, but as long as they played the same roles, they were as interchangeable as second-rate players speaking the same lines in the same theatre on different nights. All of the things that had been seeded in 1672 and 1673 had spent the next dozen years growing up into trees, some noble and well-formed, some curiously gnarled, and some struck down by lightning. Not Bulstrode had died in exile. His son Gomer now lived in Holland. Other Bulstrodes had gone over the sea to New England. This was all because Knott had attempted to indict Nell Gwynne as a prostitute in 1679, which had seemed sensational at the time. The older King Charles II had grown, the more frightened London had become of a return to popery when his brother James ascended to the throne, and the more the king needed to keep a nasty